Greetings from your fellow Sangha friends from Holland, Ireland, Scotland, and London. They'll all envy you immensely. So it's good to be here, good to be back. So, by now you're probably starting to get that the central tenet here is this transmission that really is a very straightforward and practical invitation to be as you are, rest in God. Be nothing, do nothing, get nothing, become nothing, seek for nothing, relinquish nothing. Otherwise, sweetheart, relax. Relax. The incessant grasping, chasing, trying to get, trying to fix, trying to improve, trying to make it different. All of the activity that emerges out of that primary identification with being a separate someone who's dissatisfied. And that's really the primary cause underlying all loss of peace. And it's so simple, the invitation, and yet 180 degrees the opposite of everything that we've been taught, of all of our usual habits, and most of the ways we've grown up thinking we need to live our life. And so a big part of what I've been exploring over the years is what supports us to engage this practice? What really can we do? If the primary practice is undoism, then what can we do that doesn't create more of a knot, that is practical, pragmatic, helpful, gives us a deeper capacity to be undefended, be still, be open into all of our experiences and let all of the experiences of our life deepen us, enrich us, awaken us, which is the potential. So you'll notice that on your seat there's a diagram. That's a teaching that I always give on retreats, and I thought it would be helpful to introduce you to it, because today I want to open up the whole subject of trust. So last month I gave you an alternate interpretation of the Passover and the Easter story. And you saw in both the character of Moses and also obviously in Jesus, virtues that most traditions would acknowledge are characteristics of a mature soul. And so I was mentioning last time that Moses really exemplified these virtues that you'll see here listed as the Paleozoike. And so in a way, the trust, the love of the truth, the curiosity, the non-attack, the humility, the willingness, the patience, these are all virtues that we can cultivate in daily life. And each one of these virtues we could stay on just for a whole year and we'd not come close to unpacking as much as can really be mined in all of these virtues. But I wanted to focus today on giving you a bit of an introduction to what we can cultivate that creates more of a container, a rounded and true container that makes it much more easy to practice, be here, be undefended, be present, be still. And today I want to focus on trust, because trust is the gateway pillar. Trust really opens up and supports all of the other pillars, and so it's there that I want to begin. So trust is really important to us on the path, because without sufficient trust, we can't open up. Because the spiritual path invites us to welcome and allow constant change and transformation, asks us to let go of what's familiar to us, asks us to let go of habits, patterns of thinking, emotional reactive habits, ways of being that are contracted, that are self-centered, but that are very familiar, that we've come to think of as me. So really, spiritual awakening invites you to let go of me. Make no bones about it. And that feels very scary to our egos that like to be comfortable. Our egos cleave to what's familiar to us because it gives a semblance of security. And our ego fundamentally always feels insecure because really what it is a sense of self cut off from the supply and trying to cope with that. And I'm not interested in helping you cope with that. That's far too small a goal. We're here to actually open up into who you really are. Who are you deeper than this structure of thoughts, history, mind? Who are you deeper than your emotions? Who are you, really? This is the perennial spiritual question. And in a way, it's not really possible for us to lead a true and authentic life unless we grapple with that question. But it's a question that can't be answered by any concept. You've probably noticed that so far on your journey. Even to say, I am love, isn't quite it. Isn't quite it. Yes, and. You know, what we are is so profound and mysterious. And so we're here to really engage with that journey, and therefore we need trust to open into unfamiliar territory within, and also just in our human life. If we don't have much trust, we will find the inevitable changes of life, changes that occur in our relationships, changes that occur in our bodies, the aging process, the death process, loss of what we've come to be attached to. We'll find that very, very painful, very difficult. And so it's needed. It's absolutely central as a support, as a necessary virtue that supports us in our human life and on the deeper levels of spiritual awakening. So it's something that I've been working with inside in my own inner practice for decades, and really trust until it's absolutely total, at which point there is no more fear, there is no more contraction, is a continuum. So wherever we are, whether we find ourselves relatively able to trust or whether trust is really tough for us, doesn't matter. We can take in these teachings to where we happen to find ourselves. So I think I mentioned to you before, I think I have, I'm not sure, that in the years post the awakening in the cave with Ramana, my life went through enormous changes. Within a 6-month process, absolutely every support structure that supported the sense of me that I knew was gone. So that included the form of my spiritual practice, my spiritual teacher, my husband, my work that I thought was my lifetime's work, the community that I had founded, the home that I lived in, and the country. There was not a single thing that was unaffected by this change. And although I could hear the inner voice, the inner wisdom, helping me to see that what was happening was that the support to my familiar identity needed to dissolve to so that the deeper awareness could actually have a chance to integrate, even though I understood that the changes that were happening were necessary and ultimately helpful. As a human being, we still contract when there's that degree of change. And so for me, the degree of the change and how rapid they were, how they all came at once, was pretty intense. And so I found myself waking up at 2 a.m. in the middle of the night, my husband sleeping in the room next to me. He'd already decided, he'd already come to the conclusion that the marriage was over without any real process or dialogue between us. So it was an experience of total powerlessness, helplessness in and amidst all of this change. And I'd wake up having a full-on panic attack, something I've never had in my life. And in the midst of the panic attack, where I can hardly even draw breath, I hear the same inner voice saying, "This is not what it seems, go and meditate." So I would meditate. Thankfully, 20 years deep spiritual practice kicked in to support me, which was an immense grace. But it would take about an hour for my nervous system to actually calm down and to really open up in the silence. And one night after such an episode, I asked the same presence that was there, that never really left, that came through in the cave, "Help me understand this. Help me understand what all of this is for, so I can go with it. So I can actually go with it, willingly." And what I got back were a series of questions in return. So I was asked, "Who are you without?" And so the "who are you without" questions, if you just imagine every single tiny little attachment that you have to anything familiar, I was asked my version of that. And the end, after being asked, "Who are you without your husband, your home, your role as teacher, a community, a country, a body, friends, social standing, status," I was asked, "Who are you without Miranda?" And as I was writing the letter M of my name, the pen ran out. So it was very apparent in that moment, I got it, what was being asked. It was a totality of surrender. Nothing familiar at all. Now, you know, most of us in a moment like that, it feels you really are at the edge of yourself. You really are at the edge of the void, the edge of everything you know. And so, in a way, that's where trust is really necessary. When we are at the edge of our familiar identity and our familiar patterns and our familiar structures of support, and it's obvious that they're not actually able to sustain or support you anymore. They're going, they're moving, they're changing. So in a way, it took a lot of trust to say, okay, to just say yes, having no idea what it would be like. And so in the year after that, I lived homeless, without a fixed abode. My practice was not making any decision based on fear. So I trained myself to ask of the presence, "What now?" And listen, and then act. Now, this was an immense training in trust and listening and not picking up the usual defenses and habits. It was edgy as hell, but incredibly alive. I came alive like never before. Fear dropped away to such a degree, felt so free. The clarity, practical clarity that was needed to move to America knowing no one, just taking the next step from the guidance, dealing with obstacles like the U.S. Immigration Department.
Oh.
I mean, really, obstacles like that, that, that was edgy. Like, does the U.S. Immigration Department work off the same current as my guidance list? Let's see, really. So, bit by bit, and so a lot of what I come to learn about trust and surrender really comes from that period in my life of really living without much of an ego structure and without any real support for that structure, and really having to turn radically to a deeper support structure than the one that I had constructed for myself as a child, as we all do. See, we all form a network of support structures based on our experience in the first stage of our life, and particularly the pre-verbal stage, where we're forming foundations about how safe it is or isn't, how much support is here or isn't here, whether I'm loved or not. And of course, if we had an enlightened being for a mother, perhaps there wasn't much problem with trust, but most of us didn't have an enlightened being for a mother, and even if we did, who knows? I actually know someone whose mother is clearly enlightened and he's pretty screwy, so who knows? Maybe this is just the human condition. But you see, we learn to contract, and we, through those felt experiences when we're young, of experiencing ourselves as separate, separate from the holding, separate from the love, separate from the safety. And that's where all these foundations of mistrust come from, that direct us to control, contract, effort, push, you know, that really form a lot of our habitual reactions. And they can be hard to break. But it's important that we investigate our mistrust, because whenever we bring our mistrust, our observations, our sense of separation and the defenses and the fears and the beliefs and the justifications for those beliefs, when we bring all that to the light of the awareness, notice how the awareness isn't judgmental. The awareness doesn't tell you that you're wrong for having learned to mistrust and contract and control. It just allows everything to oxygenate and open up and heal. And so a big part of what I'm inviting you to do is to really be honest and look at, you know, the mistrust that you have, that really is the beliefs and the assumptions of a little child. So when we're really little, we're forming our foundations of whether we're loved or safe, held enough, based a lot of the time on our mother, mothering influence in particular. You know, we start, all because all we know is our immediate environment, we start assuming that however she is how the world is. Have you noticed that? And so we presume that, you know, the world's going to behave to us in the same way our mother did or our father did. And we need to see this for what it is, to see that that's not objective truth. That is the assumptions of a little one that needs to be brought to light, needs to be met with compassion. And also to see that those filters aren't truth. They're filters. I've used the analogy here before of the cracked glasses. If we wore glasses and had someone trample on them and they were cracked, and we put sellotape on them to try and hold the cracks in place, and then we put the glasses back on, everything we would see would be completely distorted, would it not? We would not be seeing accurately. We would be seeing through distorted lenses. Well, that's what our assumptions that we've made based on how mother and father and early environment was, that dictates our views and our justifications for our defenses. We're looking through cracked glasses. So it's important to understand that, see what the cracks really are, and also be interested to see, well, what else is here? Now, what else is here? So as I was learning this kind of advanced course in trust in the 2 years post the Ramana Awakening, coming to America, beginning a whole new life, not even fully back together as a person, I started to read various different scriptures and to see what they had to say about the process of establishing full trust. And I found something really helpful in the Manual for Teachers in A Course in Miracles. It's in a section called Characteristics of the Teachers of God, Development of Trust. And it outlines the stages of trust developing. So I wanted to just name them a little here, hoping this is not going to be too dense, but I found it really, really helpful. So it talked about the first stage in the development of trust as the period of undoing, of learning to trust that when changes occur in our inner life or in our outer life, even though we often experience them initially as painful, as something's being taken away from us, to trust that they're helpful, that all things are helpful, that the ground of reality or God is a beneficent force, interested not in us being comfortable, but interested in us being awake, being free, being what we actually are. And so the period of undoing, where we go through stages where it seems like things are being taken away, we're invited to see that the changes are helpful changes, even though we might experience pain amidst them. And if we can allow the period of undoing, there's a next stage that the Course calls period of sorting out. And this is a process of discrimination. Discrimination based on seeing what is truly valuable versus what is actually valueless. And so when we really discriminate, we see that what's truly valuable are things that really support us deepening into essence. So we see that if we use that as the basis for discrimination, what supports us to be present? What supports us to be real? What supports us to face what we need to face? What supports us to be at peace versus what's valueless? The trinkets and the distractions that we might have become attached to, but perhaps are not actually serving us anymore. And sometimes this includes forms of relationship, but sometimes a form of a relationship has really gone as far as it can. And that doesn't mean it's wrong. It means that the learning, the mutual positive process of growth and nurturing and discovery has gone as far as it can. And so if we can discriminate that, then it helps us to let go and allow the changes, allow what's happening. And as the Tao says, to ride the horse in the direction that the horse is going. So the next stage, if we can allow the undoing, the sorting out, is the period of relinquishment, which is the actual letting go. I had to let go of everything I knew and held dear, everything that I thought made me. It was out of date. It couldn't support the deep intention of the heart anymore. A shift had occurred. And so the period of relinquishment is really an invitation to actually allow death, which is a big part of what we were exploring last time we met, the crucifixion story. And that deep transformation always does ask for some kind of death, some letting go of what's really actually done. And then if we can allow that, which is really the hardest part, there's a period of settling down where there's more peace and acceptance, more presence, more capacity to just be now, to not be constantly referencing the past, referencing our concepts. Ever notice how so much social conversation involves somebody saying something and then the other person going, oh yeah, I know somebody who went to London, and they wrap it on about somebody they know, and it's just kind of filling up space. It's not really a real conversation. It's not present. So in the period of settling down, we find ourselves settling into the present with acceptance. And then there's another stage that the Course calls the period of unsettling. So it's a deeper level of humility and surrender, where we realize we of ourselves aren't capable of discriminating the valuable from the valueless, because our mind is so patterned. It really only knows how to do what it was trained to do in the past. And so to really accept this brings us into a deeper humility and receptivity and surrender, allowing the not known, and really being obedient to a direction that's not historical, which really means being radically undefended and really trusting that as we're undefended, we're not vulnerable to attack. We're actually held with a totality of love beyond our wildest imagination. And if we can allow that, then we land in what the Course calls the period of achievement, in which I find this term interesting. The full transfer occurs. What's the full transfer? It's a more substantial shift into the essential realm, in which we're not referencing me and my for everything. In the East, they call it no self. But in the Course, they call it the full transfer of knowledge, where all of the gifts of the pure realms are available to us. And the more we take the risk to be undefended and trust that it will be okay, the more this becomes apparent in our direct experience, that we don't have to try to be loving. Love is what's living us. We don't have to try to be wise. The wisdom is. We don't have to become happy. Joy is our intrinsic nature. That's what's meant by a full transfer. There's an establishment across the bridge from the familiar to the eternal. So I know that's kind of a lot, but I found it incredibly helpful in my own process of the process of trust amidst everything unfamiliar, in the wake of a deep awakening and letting it actually land. that inevitably takes time. So it's the trust that we can lean into to let go of the control, to relax the contraction, to rest in I don't know, and not leave, and let grace act upon us.